And the other thing, of course, and in that landing sequence, is the steady of the ship. And you have to get that plane down fast, and the trap has to bang. And that LSO is key to the ship's movement,
right?
Signal, and the firing. In other words, he has to make sure that thing is fired. And he was firing it, the trap.
So that was just one button to push.
Yeah, he's got a lot to do in just a matter of a couple seconds.
So if one of the other things that I was interested in, which, and there's a little bit of the discrepancy in the documents, saying that the aircraft comes in to hover over the deck for the hookup anywhere from, I've seen 20 to 60 feet above the deck. And I'm wondering if you could sort of narrow that down a little bit.
Well, I think that initially it probably would have been higher. But I think as time went on, it was lower. They had a better feel, everything lower. And if you had asked me, I'd have said 30 feet to make it different.
Right.
But it's in there. And they don't like to go higher. It's too high. They've losing too much of the ship.
Mm-hmm. Already
down in where they can, they got to see that ship, and they got to feel where they are, and that's very essential. And I think they have lights now to tell them where. Just can't remember. I think they have lights on the hangar to tell them forward or back or something like this.
So while they're going through this operation, and even while they're hooked up before they're hauled down to the deck, they are hovering, but they're maintaining forward motion.
Oh yeah.
And the ship is steaming along at 25 knots or whatever.
Not that high, but anyhow, it's steaming along, sure.
And they would be maintaining forward motion at the same speed that the ship was?
Relative to the ship, they're stopped.
Mm-hmm. All right. Relative to the ship, they're stopped?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wasn't sure
See, they would have, they've got a, they're into a headwind of about, see, they, that's the ship. They come in and they cock like that, and they're going this way. And so they're into a wind speed of, could be anything, 20, 25 knots, whatever. And then they're over that position, and they just run the ship to steady.
All right. Okay. What would be a stalls for a seeking helicopter?
No stall.
No stall.
No, the only thing would be if you lost rotor RPM, then you'd be in trouble. But you keep your rotor RPM, you're okay.
All right. Okay.
And especially into wind like that, they don't need a lot of power.
No?
No.
So what would be the average, if you can use such a word, for time involved from the hover to the hookup to the haul down to firing the bear trap? What would they normally sort of shoot for
at an operational? That's a very good question. Very good question. Operationally, of course, you're shooting for the absolute minimum time, because as soon as you start going on a steady course, then theoretically you're a dead duck for somebody looking for you.
Right, and that's why I
asked. So the thing is, as you come in, the ship will tell you its flying course. And as you come in, then the ship will turn on its flying course, and you'll get your green light, and you'll come over. I don't know what they've got it down to, quite honestly. I would say over, down, up. They're probably talking somewhere in the neighborhood of, I would say, a minute or under.
A minute or under?
Yeah.
That's pretty quick time. It is.
I would think I might be off in heavy weather, might be more than that. And if it's bad, they got to back off and come in again.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll bet you Joe was getting close to that.
That's quick. I would have had no idea. I would have said maybe 3 or 4 minutes, but I'm not the pilot.
We used to land the aircraft every 30 seconds, 20 seconds to 30 seconds. Yeah, I would think some of them are pretty good, and it might be a little bit fast, but it's not a lot, not 5 minutes or 10 minutes or anything like that. It's faster than that.
So as the CEO of VX-10, and you were there for both the Assiniboine and the Annapolis trials, and from everything that I've been able to see and from what I've heard from other individuals, an entirely successful program, What do you attribute the success to?
I attribute it to the people. I attribute it, as I said, initially headquarters had done their work. The preliminary work in the two, the frigate and the destroyer was good work. What's his name? Johnny, not Mason, but Johnny from back in Ottawa. Excellent guy. He was early on in the design work for the chopper, for the haul down. And all of them together had put together the groundwork extremely well, Ken Gibson, his team, and Rod Bays. The directive that came out was, I think, an astonishingly good directive. The team that I was able to get together through the help of headquarters and some finger pointing was exceptional. And I was blessed with Joe Sosnkowski and Peter Charlton and Frank Anderson, plus Zbigniew and those guys. They were first class. And we did get a lot of support from the Admiral and what have you. We had problems there, but they were natural problems, in my opinion. But we had to overcome. And sometimes it was, we used to curse the hell out of them. They used to curse the hell out of us. But people, I think. Good, highly qualified people. And I had Stretch, Dave Tate, Zbigniew. That is essential. You couldn't do it with just an ordinary, untrained person because you had to develop.
So where did the test pilots, that training, was that been at Pax River?
Yeah. Joe, myself, Joe, Larry. Larry did a helicopter one. Stretch and Jerry Moore were all Patuxent trained test pilots. Dave Tate was English trained.
All right.
And I think we had about 12 or 13 test pilots in the Navy throughout the history. I had that many at one time. That's pretty lucky.
Makes a big difference.
It makes a big, big difference because they knew what they were trying to do and it was just methodical. Joe was excellent.
Lieutenant Gibbs comment the other day, and he attributes the success in part to the small size of the RCN and how keen everybody was to get on with this particular project. Would you also agree with that comment?
Oh, I'd agree with that. I'd qualify it in a different way. I think the small size, but I'll go back to what I said. We knew what we were after, and then it was put together well, and I had these highly trained people. Smallness, yes, and that you knew everybody involved, and that helped, and there was a sort of feeling of, we can do it. That ran through the small size of our aviation. Yeah, he's quite right in that. But the fact that the X-10 could work directly with Ottawa was nowhere in their Canadian military organization was that possible, where a lieutenant commander could go right. If I had a problem with the command, something I didn't like, I would fly up or talk to them, or I'd go to them and say, this is hindering our work and whatnot, and then I'd sit back. But working directly with Ottawa, using the local admiral's assets and directing them to help us get this project was something that you can't do now. When this organization of VX-10 was ended with the amalgamation, AET in Cold Lake took over. They didn't have that relationship. They envied us like hell because we could bypass the local command structure and go straight to Ottawa. Ottawa, similarly, comes straight to us and demand answers from us directly. No long papers, a message.
And that was enough.
And that was enough. And that gave us direction, authority, and everything. We could just jump in an airplane, go south. I was given expense money and everything. If I thought I had to go, I had to justify, bang, I'd send the detachment off. And but that was part of the reason it worked, because we didn't suffer huge delays because of this command stuff and what have you.
I have one last question for you. As early as 1955, Lieutenant Commander J.H. Johnson, engineer, and he was at that time Director of Air Engineering, was evaluating a proposal that had come in from Gen Air for landing a helicopter aboard a small warship. And he suggested at that time that that the RCN use a cable, and to use that cable to haul a helicopter to the deck. And in 64, 65, we're working and testing this concept, gone through a number of trials. The British and the Americans didn't really think it was possible in 55, 56, and they had chosen to go their own separate ways to develop their own concept. Earlier in the interview, you had made a comment that when you were CEO of VX-10, even at that late date in 63, 64, you made the comment that the Brits and the Americans weren't too keen on what the Canadians were doing and still didn't think that it was possible. Is that...
I think that's a fairly accurate assessment. I would say they were interested because we went and we briefed the Americans, but not interested enough to hover over us or anything like that. Now, they had a person in Ottawa who had access, who was usually on staff as a liaison. He had access to information. And so it was going back down south, and we weren't really hiding anything spectacular. This is just a landing system we're talking about. And but no, the Brits had a harpoon idea.
Right, that was developed by Sproul, I think.
And it never really took off. Now, this was quite novel in the fact it was a big helicopter on a small ship. Yeah, and it that was quite an achievement. And Johnson, he's dead now. But he was a very, very clever guy. Likeable and clever.
Struck me as being very bright.
Now, the other one is Johnny. God, I can see him.
Doherty or?
No, Johnny. Johnny. I'll think of his name. If I do, I'll call you. These other names?